From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. President Trump will head to Charlotte next year for the Republican National Convention. But that's not stopping the Charlotte City Council from voting to condemn controversial comments from the president. North Carolina lawmakers continue to tweak the rules for grading the state's public schools. You'll hear their latest ideas. Speaking of education, we'll discuss a special state district. It's designed to turn around North Carolina's most challenging traditional public schools. And as the science of genetic editing advances, how free should parents be to choose their children's traits? It's a topic that led to an interesting discussion recently at Duke University. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
It is a game changer. That is the word from supporters about reforms to North Carolina's laws that govern distillers of liquor, reforms that are part of a broader effort to free entrepreneurs from burdensome rules and update North Carolina's alcohol sales and distribution system. Carolina Journal has been covering developments every step of the way this legislative session. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now with the very latest. Welcome back, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
All right. So come September 1st, the number of new rules on distillers are going to go into effect, loosening some things up. Tell us about it.
The bill was Senate Bill 290, which folded in two different measures. And what this basically does is it places craft distillers closer to the same status that craft breweries and craft wineries have in North Carolina. Spirits have always been treated differently than beer and wine in North Carolina. They're controlled through the ABC Commission. They're sold through ABC stores. There are local ABC boards, 170 of them in North Carolina, that have a lot to do with product placement and things like that. And this bill essentially modernizes the system. What it does, for one thing, it eliminates the previous rule, which only existed for a year, that if you visited a distillery, you could only buy five bottles per year.
Why five? Does anyone really know?
Because it was better than one, which was the limit.
Which was the original.
It was the original
limit,
which Governor Pat McCrory, fortunately, started loosening that limit. And then it went to five a year ago, and now it's up to unlimited numbers of purchases at distilleries directly. And some of the concerns about that were really unfounded. It was, well, you know, will people pay taxes and things like that? I mean, distilleries will be selling alcohol at retail, and they will pay all the local taxes, all the state taxes, all the federal taxes, and so that'll take place. But that's a big that's a boon for local distillers, because even though North Carolina has a statewide system of alcoholic beverage control and you have all the products listed at the state level, counties are not required to carry anything. I mean, county boards have great autonomy to decide what they're going to sell and what they're not. And you had situations quite often in which restaurant might want a particular local spirit to mix in a cocktail they sell. And if their local ABC store doesn't have it or the local ABC board doesn't carry it, the restaurateur would have to actually drive to a county where they sold that particular spirit and purchase it and drive it back. And so now this law is going to do away with all those restrictions.
Rick, there had been critics of the loosening of these restrictions who were concerned that if you do this, that it's essentially encouraging people to drink more and drink more freely. But the supporters, including the researchers at the John Locke Foundation, have said this is about freedom and entrepreneurship. And it's not about encouraging drinking, but letting entrepreneurs handle more of their business. And then consumers get to make the choice. Do I want to buy it or not?
That's right. And as with so many other products like that dealing with alcoholic beverages, the craft distillers are not selling cheap product usually. I mean, if you're concerned about overconsumption of alcohol and availability, the sort of products that you're going to probably find at every ABC store are going to be a lot less expensive than something you would find at a craft distiller. And so, or at a craft winery or at a craft brewery. So consumption is a completely separate issue from allowing distillers to sell more of their products on premises or to have other things available. If someone wants to, buy a cheap bottle of vodka for $7, that's one thing. You're probably not going to go to a craft distiller and pay 50 or 30 or 40 if you're worried about overconsumption. So I think that was a bit of a red herring. And the other thing, a couple of other things this bill would do that would be useful for consumers is it's going to allow tastings at ABC stores. So something that happens in almost every state with looser spirits laws is that you can actually have representatives from the different distilleries pouring their own product there. You can comparison taste. If you're from a distributor that handles a lot of different labels, you can have different tastings. You have beer and wine tastings all the time now in grocery stores and other retailers. You'll be able to do the same thing now at ABC stores for alcohol. And also you can have tastings at farmers markets and events and things like that of spirits. You've had beer and wine for years now, but now you can have spirits in limited sources.
You bring up a really fascinating point. So the beer and wine folks have been treated differently up to this point. So this new legislation brings the liquor distillers more into line, making it more of a level playing field for everybody.
Right. And that's all they've really wanted, because you're probably going to see distillers operating more like craft breweries and starting to open their own restaurants. You have a couple of major operations like that right now in North Carolina, one in Chapel Hill with the Top of the Hill outfit, which has its own distillery and its own craft brewery and its own large restaurant. But you'll see a lot more of that. In a lot of places, you will have a small brewery that might have food trucks around several days a week if they don't have their own restaurant on premises. You'll start to see that sort of thing in distilleries now too, and you'll see a lot more entrepreneurship taking place, which will be really important because North Carolina's craft distilleries have really prided themselves on using a lot of local agricultural products, and so that's yet another thing that the State Department of Agriculture has been very supportive of this notion, because they've really worked on branding North Carolina merchandise and the whole Got to Be NC campaign that's pretty ubiquitous. But they've found that it's very useful to do that, and it's a way to sell North Carolina as a place to come and taste something really different. And so that's something that state government has sort of worked at odds with itself in some ways, with some folks on the ABC level saying, no, we've got to rein this stuff in. And in other cases, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Commerce and Tourism saying, well, no, let's see if we can't promote our own products.
We talk a lot about changes that are coming. One of the changes is going to be taking place on a lot of college campuses, public universities in North Carolina, because the legislature has given them an option having to do with alcohol sales.
That's right. For the first time, you'll have the potential of having beer and wine sales at events at university campuses on campus, which you did not have previously at public universities. Wake Forest University, for instance, which is a private college, a Baptist university, actually does allow alcohol sales at football games. And you will see this more and more. It had the unusual situation at NC State in which you had the PNC Arena, which is where the Carolina Hurricanes play hockey, and also the NC State men's basketball team plays. They would sell beer during hockey games, but not during basketball games.
Right.
And now that's going to change because of that. Some folks think it might have a impact on the tailgating experience, and that people who would leave the stadium at halftime and not come back may actually stick around now instead.
And as of the time that you and I are talking, Rick, I think it's just one of the UNC system campuses that has opted not to adopt the sale of alcohol on the campus during those sporting events, and that would be UNC Pembroke.
Right, and that's affiliated, or the school that's closest to the Lumbee Indian tribe, and there are some concerns about whether or not they would want to do that there. I think the Pembroke's major sport is baseball and softball, and so there's not a lot of not as much alcohol sales and that sort of thing affiliated with that as it would be with, say, football and basketball. So it may not be a major deal anyway.
Well, Carolina Journal has been doing a lot of reporting on this as the different bills made their way through the state legislature and become law. There's some very good pieces at CarolinaJournal.com that kind of list out what the changes are and what you can expect to see around North Carolina. All of this part of a broader effort. North Carolina is still one of the control states. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Charlotte is slated to host the Republican National Convention next year. That's not stopping Charlotte City Council from voting to call out controversial comments from President Trump over the past 2 years. The most recent, his criticism of four Democratic congresswomen. They're known collectively as the Squad. Justin Harlow recently launched the council's debate of a resolution condemning Trump's words.
It is unfortunate that we actually have to have this resolution. In my opinion, we shouldn't have to openly and unequivocally speak against racism in 2019, but that is the reality. And so we are, and we should. I believe that people should know where we stand as elected officials on this. While these comments come from our highest levels of government, as local elected officials, we are responsible to the people we see every day in our neighborhoods, in our grocery stores. And those people often are immigrants. Those people often are people of color. And so this resolution seeks to not talk so much about a convention or political parties, but simply about what should be not debatable, simply what should be a non-starter all the time. Racism. Xenophobia.
Council member Dimple Ajmera placed Trump's comments in a personal context.
Send her back or go back. That brings tears to my eyes because I've been called that many times and I've been said that many times. So when those words were said at the rally, it brought tears to my eyes. And unfortunately, this has become a norm. And it should not be. And when I look at this resolution, it's not about being a partisan. Instead, it's about condemning dangerous rhetoric. We live in unprecedented times where hate crimes have gone up in double digits based on race, based on religion, in double digits. And this is not time to be neutral. We all live in the same house, and that is the American house. So from this house, we are telling White House that racism, xenophobia, and hate has no place in our city and will not be tolerated.
Not everyone was on board with the Charlotte City Council voting to condemn President Trump's comments. Council member Ed Driggs objected.
I want to make it clear that I don't personally endorse the way the president has chose to express himself on this occasion and others. I think those of you who know me realize that I'm kind of in the mold of a Reagan Republican. I don't conduct myself this way. I wouldn't want to be measured by that behavior. I do believe the president has pursued policies that will benefit our country, which is why I continue to support him in spite of my disagreement with some of his utterances, I guess I'll call it. He would not be where he is today if he were not tapping into the anger of many Americans who feel that they have been treated badly by people on the other side of the aisle. He didn't create the tension that we're experiencing. It isn't of his making. It was there before. He is actually the result of the tension. How does a guy like that get elected to be president of the United States in the first place? I mean, seriously. And that did not happen because of the action of one man or one party. That is a product of this manifest warfare that is going on the national level. My second point, though, is that I don't think it's wise for city council to get drawn into the turmoil of national political discourse when we have so many local issues to address. We have generally managed to avoid this kind of vitriol that you're objecting to tonight here on city council, and I don't see any value in joining in now. When Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez referred to the detention centers for immigrants as concentration camps, she did so intentionally, knowing the shock value it would have, because just about everyone associates concentration camps with genocide. Why is nobody offended by that? I don't think we have really good behavior on either side, and I'm not prepared to lay the blame for the situation that we're in, that none of us likes, entirely at the feet of one man. We should all look inside ourselves. Listen to the anger here tonight. Racist, bigot. We are here to express our hatred of a guy that we consider to be hateful. Look at yourselves. It takes two. It really does.
Braxton Winston explained that he would rather be debating other items.
I wish that we were sitting here having a conversation where we discuss politics, where it was debating the use of tax policy and spending and tariffs and entitlements and what we need to advocate for on our federal legislative agenda or what we ask our lobbyists to engage the federal government to do, but that's not what is going on here. The people that have pushed this resolution are not here because of political, philosophical differences. We have a man in the highest office in the land who is the epitome of what a racist is.
Councilmember Tariq Bokhari questioned Charlotte City Council's decision to wade into national political debates.
I oppose phrases like send her back in the strongest possible way that I can relate to you. I think it is unconstitutional. I think it's tyrannical. I think it's wrong. And I think if you are out there and you think that's something that's okay to say, don't associate yourself with my Republican Party and don't associate yourself with the form of government we have here and what's okay. So for those of you looking for someone to call out and say, this is not okay, let me be the first to say it. This is not okay. I oppose all forms of hate speech, racism, xenophobia, and bigotry. But now let me take you on a little bit of a side journey here, because don't be mistaken, that is not what we are here doing today. One, this is not a comprehensive list, right? This is a list that we see today, and it is not all forms, it is some forms. And if we want to be in the business of going out and being the sole source of capturing all forms of racism and bigotry and xenophobia, we're going to need more city staff. We're going to need a lot more people that are going to keep a comprehensive list of all of this, because I'm not sure if this is what the voters of Charlotte asked us to do when we ran for city council, but we're not going to be able to just randomly jot things down we hear. We're going to have to take it very seriously and create this comprehensive list. But that brings a second problem to play, right? Once we have that complete list, two, it's hard to determine what's in the hearts of the people that are saying this stuff. So we're going to need another staff of psychologists and people to look and say, well, does that person really mean a racist thing? Or are they just saying their opinion in another view? And you know what's so bothersome to me about this is in this day and age, it feels like the word racism is thrown around a lot like the word witch was in the 1600s.
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, you don't like that? Right. I bet not. But in the 1600s, you never knew what motivated the accuser of calling someone a witch, and the accused had a near impossible task in proving that they were not. That seems very similar to how we use the word racism today. And I'm not by any stretch trying to say there aren't people with racism in their heart saying things out there that we are condemning right now. I'm saying, how are we to be the judge of all of that? And isn't it going a little bit too far?
Not too far for the Charlotte City Council majority. The council voted to condemn President Trump's comments. Trump is expected to travel to Charlotte in 2020 for the Republican National Convention. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are tweaking the way the state grades public schools. Republican Senator Rick Horner explained a recent bill dealing with the issue.
This bill does three things. It makes permanent the 15-point scale for grading our schools. It directs the State Board of Education to adopt emergency rules in preparation for permanent rulemaking as a result of a court case. And it also directs the Board of Education to study reporting methods for school accountability. We've had a lot of discussion about the different measures and how they're weighted and whether they should be separated, as direct and report to us by February next year.
Democratic Senator Joyce Waddell asked colleagues to make a substantive change to the bill. It deals with the way schools are graded.
Sometimes we have unintended consequences when it comes to grading schools. As we look at some of our schools in Mecklenburg, we have 19 schools that are A schools, 48 B schools, 60 C schools, and 38 D schools 7 F schools. We think about F schools, and we think about the stigma that it often puts on not only the students, the community, and people who are moving to the city. I think we have to do a better job. Many of the realtors who come, and they find out here's an affluent neighborhood, but here's a school that's an F school. They don't want to move in this neighborhood. So we must do a better job when it comes to putting grades on schools.
What else says a grade of D or F hurts public schools?
That score creates a stigma. No one wants to attend a D or F school.
So what would Waddell change?
Currently, school performance scores are calculated by combining a school's achievement score and its growth score. The achievement score is weighted at 80% and the growth is weighted at 20%. This amendment would change this calculation so that that school achievement score is weighted at 51% and the growth is 49%.
Republican Rick Horner responded to Waddell's proposal.
Senator, Waddell's bill may well be the recommendation of the state board. But that's exactly why we're doing what we want to do. We have a myriad of ideas on how this should be done. And one of my arguments was we shouldn't be so quick to tell our state how to do this. And we're going to hear from the state board, and they're going to come back and make a recommendation about the weightings. And we're going to try to take a little of the legislative mandate out, and let's get their recommendations before we make a decision.
You've been listening to highlights from legislative debate. Lawmakers are tweaking the way North Carolina grades its public schools. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Thanks to scientific advances, it will become easier and easier for parents to select the traits they want in their kids. How much freedom should they have to make those selections? That was the topic of a recent lecture at Duke University. Jonathan Anomaly is a philosophy professor at the University of San Diego. He pointed to a key challenge.
So you can think of two geniuses, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. They had very different personality traits, different cognitive styles, but equally valuable in a way, right? So one is a kind of introspective geek, and another is maybe an extroverted geek too. I guess they're both geeks in a way. But, you know, sort of Jobs is the showman. He's the extrovert. He's the guy with the vision. You know, he gets up on stage and sells it. He commands attention at meetings. But that's not to say Wozniak isn't really important. And in fact, he's, I think, in a way underrated as the brains behind Apple. So here's a problem, which is we know that parents, prospective parents, rate certain measures as better than others, or certain qualities as better. And you can look at data from like OkCupid or Tinder to see this. Women prefer, for example, men who are extroverts over introverts. And there's nothing wrong with that. Extroverts tend to have more friends. They tend to do really well in social settings and so on. The problem is if everyone selected, or most people selected, in that way, we'd actually lose out on a really important source of cognitive diversity.
Anomaly offered an example involving another popular trait, openness.
Openness predicts an ability to learn from outsiders. You tend to have a low disgust reaction toward parasites. And there are a number of other things that are interesting that you can say about that. But it also can make you a sucker. And it's not a very stable strategy in a population that's not also full of people who score high on openness. So you might think either in a group setting or in a political society, depending on what we're talking about, you might want a range of people who score high and low on openness so that you get, in some sense, group learning.
Anomaly says parental choice could lead to some social imbalances, including the ratio of male versus female children.
The worry with sex ratios, of course, is that, well, in places like China, you have more than 50% male to female, and that can create possibly elevated rates of violence. Imagine if it wasn't 51-49, but 70-30 or something, right? It would completely transform the society. Some of it might have some good effects, right? There may be more polygamy or polygyny more generally that could have eugenic or dysgenic effects. It's going to affect like who gets to reproduce and how much. But there could be an elevated risk of violence and just sort of, you know, restlessness, I guess. Arms races with height, I think, are just going to happen. I don't even see how to avoid this. Females have just incredibly strong preferences for tall men. It just totally dominates almost everything else, irrationally dominates it. But it's true. And again, just look at the OkCupid data. It's been released and you just see what happens. Some women will even state on their profiles, will not date someone under a certain height. It's a deal breaker. Not are you nice or intelligent or just like don't be short. And if their preferences are that strong, people might take note of that. And they might think, well, I don't have a prejudice against, you know, height. But if I have a male, a son, then maybe I want him to be a little taller than average. Not because being tall is good. It's not. It's actually bad for your health on average. But if you want your son to command the attention of a room or the attention of a mate, you might think, well, I don't like this, but I'm one person, right? It's like dropping one vote in a ballot box. I'm not determining who's elected. We are. And I'm not we. So I'm going to do the thing that's best for my kid, not what's best for our kids.
That's philosophy professor Jonathan Anomaly of the University of San Diego. He spoke recently at Duke. Some people think the answer involves banning selection of traits among babies. Would that work?
Banning genetic selection is not going to make it go away. And we've already seen this in China, where there's a huge market for this. Places like Singapore, they're already encouraging like eugenic reproduction by getting smart people and like paying them to have kids. They're going to be absolutely the first users of this technology once it becomes viable. I think what's going to happen then is if you tried to ban it, rich people from Western countries are going to use it because they're going to be able to get around these things. They can pay the cost, things like medical tourism and so on. And other countries are going to use it. That means we'll be at a relative disadvantage. Whatever your moral views of this are, you don't want to just stop at your moral intuition in an armchair. You want to say, okay, and then what? What's going to happen when you propose this policy change? Other people predictably violate it in various ways. And then you've got a new kind of problem. You've got a new coordination problem. What are the moral consequences of that? That is a lot trickier than just sort of saying, this is wrong, I'm not going to do it, or something like that.
Anomaly prefers an alternative. He calls it regulatory parsimony.
Just calling for global bans, it's not going to work, and it doesn't necessarily have good moral consequences either. Preventing people from using these things in ways that will produce benefits for their children. We don't want to do that. We should invoke the principle of the least restrictive alternative. That's what we call it in ethics. The idea is when you need a rule or a law in order to solve a coordination problem, say a problem like pollution, climate change, something like that, where what's good for each might not be good for all, what you should do is have few laws. They should be simple in scope and just enough to get the job done. Don't try to micromanage parental choices.
Anomaly says overly complex laws would lead to new problems.
Complex laws are often easier for powerful people to navigate. And if you're worried about inequality, you're going to make it a lot worse if you pass a bunch of laws that essentially raise the relative cost of having access to this stuff. To me, the problem is going to be lowering the cost. If anything, we want to subsidize this for people who are poor and who can't otherwise afford it. If you make it either illegal or you have a bunch of laws that make it difficult to access, you're actually going to advantage the rich and the richly genetically endowed even more than they already are. and they already don't deserve, in some sense, their genetic endowment. Now you're just going to give them an even bigger premium on it, and they're going to be able to use their resources to cognitively enhance their kids.
Social norms might work better than laws, according to Anomaly.
There's a premium associated with just carrying heavy objects on a farm and just building things. But that's actually worth almost nothing at all in a developed society, because you can just replace those muscles with much stronger and more efficient machines. And so actually there's a premium on female characteristics, and my guess is that there would be an imbalance in favor of females in developed societies.
Anomaly also doesn't trust regulators to get things right.
Often central planners don't have the relevant information to allocate scarce resources effectively, and they often don't have the motivation, even when they do have the relevant information. Even if hypothetically we could think of some socially optimal or at least socially decent distribution of traits, is it likely that the regulator would find it and then implement it if that were to be found? And the answer is probably no in both cases. So I've argued somewhat controversially that the main problem with past eugenics programs is that there was too much trust put in regulators and too little trust put in social norms and decentralized provision of information, and then people using that information against the backdrop of norms to make reproductive choices that are likely to be good for their kid, and then also more generally from a social standpoint.
What's the bottom line message?
I'm not going to say that regulations in this domain are never justified. It's rather that I want to illustrate there are going to be really interesting trade-offs, not just for individuals between, you know, different traits that you're interested in, but traits that might be good from a local standpoint, but good or bad from a more global or social standpoint.
That's Jonathan Anomaly, philosophy professor at the University of San Diego. He's offering a Duke University audience insights about the future of genetic selection. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It's called the Innovative School District, a special state effort to turn around consistently low-performing public schools. One Robeson County school is in the ISD program. Now a new director has just been announced as well. Dr. Terry Stoops is following developments. He, of course, is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a refresher on what the Innovative School District is and how it was formed, what it's supposed to do.
Republican lawmakers created the Innovative School District in 2016 to try to deal with the issue of low-performing schools. We've seen state efforts to turn around low-performing schools fail, and this was a way to look at alternative ways to try to deal with the problem that we've been unable to solve, which is there are hundreds of schools in North Carolina where kids are receiving a really terrible education, and they're performing very low on state tests, and leaders are constantly – and teachers are moving in and out of the school. So to provide some stability and support for low-performing schools. The Republican lawmakers, of course, have been met with some resistance to this idea. idea because variations of it have been used in other states. But North Carolina has somewhat of a unique model in that it just chooses individual schools rather than a whole school district for the takeover. The takeover basically consists of the hiring of a consultant or an organization that oversees the operations of the school, the instructional support, hiring of the principal for the school, and they work as sort of a go-between from the school to the innovative school district office in Raleigh.
Terry, this strikes me as a story of real serious concerns. I mean, if a school is consistently performing so poorly, you can't leave the kids trapped in something like that. But it's also a story about hope, because trying something different to try to help those kids. It looks like there's one school that has been put into the innovative school district. Tell us about that and why.
The one school that's in is Southside Ashpole Elementary School in Robeson County, and it just finished its first year under the Innovative School District. The organization that was brought in to assist it, Achievement for All Children, is the organization that's overseeing the various turnaround efforts there at the elementary school. We don't know at this point how it performed in its first year, because test scores are still a month or two away. So that will be one way for us to gauge whether this turnaround effort at least is starting to be successful. The one thing that we know about school turnaround, and especially these schools, which are typically the qualifying schools for the innovative school district, are usually the bottom 5% of performing schools in the state, is that this is a multi-year effort. If we could turn around schools in a year, I think by all means we would. But this is an effort that usually takes many years. You have to get the right chemistry of teachers and administrators in there to be able to do the hard work of school turnaround.
Terry, when this was proposed that Southside Ashpole Elementary would become part of this special district, there was a lot of pushback in the community. Can we tell if parents or teachers or community leaders have started to accept this as a more hopeful proposition rather than a threatening one?
Well, there was a tremendous amount of resistance from the school board and the county commissioners, and really kudos to the then Innovative School District Superintendent Eric Hall for meeting and being very patient with the various constituencies there in Robeson County. There now has been a change of mind. You find a lot of support for the Innovative School District in that county. They're actually very happy that the Innovative School District came in and is overseeing the turnaround in that school. So really credit to those early leaders of the Innovative School District for coming in, meeting with county commissioners, school board members, and parents, and selling this idea to them and ensuring that this isn't somehow Raleigh controlling a school, but this is very much a local effort that's being led by local leaders and with the support of school boards and county commissions.
You mentioned the early leadership in this special effort. There have been a number of different leaders in this program. What's happening there?
Well, we are on, I believe, our third superintendent of the Innovative School District. James Ellerby was recently hired for that position. It's hard to say what's going on at the Department of Public Instruction and some of these leadership changes. It's not clear whether the problem has to do with the organizational culture of the Department of Public Instruction, or whether there had been tension between the operator of the school and the Innovative School District and perhaps the teachers. There's a lot of moving parts here, and if you don't have the right person in that position, I could see that not being a long-term a job for someone that's unable to manage the various levels of governance that occur here in an innovative school.
That's such an important point, because on the surface, when you hear there's been a turnover and three different leaders in a couple of years, you're thinking, my gosh, something bad is going on in there. Perhaps so, but isn't it fair to say that for some something special like this, a very important specialized program, you've got to find the right person to be able, as you said, to deal with all the different pressures. My goodness, it's got to be a very, very difficult job.
And one of the biggest pressures is the timing. And this is something that will be hopefully rectified in legislation that's been proposed in the House that's now in the Senate, is that test scores come out, and once the test scores come out, they have to quickly determine which schools qualify. And then they have to quickly find an operator for that school. And then they have to go to that community and convince the school board and county commission that this is a good idea. And then the whole process of transferring some of the assets and resources to the innovative school district starts. In other words, there is basically a 6-month time frame in which all of this would have to take place.
That sounds almost impossible.
It's really difficult, extremely difficult. And that was one of the complaints of some of the folks that were involved in the ISD, is that it was an unreasonable timeline. So they're trying to fix that timeline, make the decision sooner, so to give them more of an opportunity to reach out to communities and to touch base with those who would be affected by the change.
Terry, there are some folks who take a look at a low performing school and would say, well, this is simply an issue of money. We've got to focus in on more resources. We've got to pay teachers more. We've got to provide a lot more per pupil expenditure, et cetera. I know you've written a lot about this, saying that certainly money is a factor. But talk a little bit about the approach that will be required to try to turn around a school that has such low performance.
Well, it starts with something that money can't buy, which is high expectations. And unfortunately, you find that in low-performing schools, there's very low expectations of the kids. That's reinforced by the principal and the teachers. And that's the culture that persists, and that's one of the reasons why the school doesn't perform well. So that's definitely part of it. But what the Innovative School District allows these schools to have is flexibility, is to do different things, to have the charter school-like flexibility that enables them to maybe customize classes, to not have to worry about things like class size.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.